I'm an alcoholic. My name's Andy. I don't hate that. It's a funny story about tonight's speaker and how we ended up getting him. Get closer. All right. You guys hear me in the back? All right. So funny story about the speaker is, and he doesn't know this, I don't think. Maybe he does. I don't know. During speaker selection, we kind of like, we'd gotten into groups and invited AA's, the community, to come listen to them and help us pick out the speakers. And little did I know that I wasn't actually in the original group. He made it through the initial rounds, you know. And during the final selection, we were listening to them. And I'm listening to this tape, and, like, I realized two things. I was like, first one, I was like, oh, fuck, that's Josh H. Like, I listened to that when I had, like, 3 months sober for the first time and listened to it multiple times. And the second thing I was listening to, I'm like, oh, shit, that's where I stole that from. You know, I say shit, I'm like, oh, okay, that's where that came from. But what was important about that early on was when I had 3 months, I didn't know that you guys existed. I didn't know that young people in general existed in Alcoholics Anonymous. Like, I was at a place in my life where I was broken and I was destroyed, and I'd come in and out of the rooms for 2 years, and I was just at a point where I was willing to do whatever it takes to stay sober, right? This was not in my peripheral vision anywhere. It was basically like some 50-year-old dudes in a basement at like 7:30 in the morning with big books, and that was it. Like, my fellowship was like eggs and coffee after that, and then like would drop me off at my mom and dad's, and I would go hang out there and like look at people on Facebook my age, and that was like the closest contact I had. But I was like listening to this tape, and especially early on, like, I will identify with anything but the message, so I like cling to outside issues, right? It's like, I will. My sponsor was only chosen because his wife was Jewish, and that was like the closest thing that I could identify with. And I heard the speaker, right? And I was like, that dude is fucking nuts. But the thing is, like, he like did this young. Like, I was like, I heard a message and I heard these things, and like, you know, I was hearing all these outside things, you know, like the adoption, like the fear and the fucking suicide, like all these things that I could identify with. And I'm like sitting in my parents' house in my bed with my headphones on, and I was like, all right, like, I'm not alone, right? Like, I was so prepared to just like, if this is as good as it gets, I'm okay with that. Like, regardless if I have friends or anything like that. And I needed to hear this. I needed to hear someone young in AA and know that, like, this wasn't it. Like, there was more beyond this basement. And I'm so glad that all you guys are here. And when it started going 3 months and under, like, I am so thankful that, like, those people are here. And you get to experience this and realize that, like, there is something beyond that. So without that, I'll give you guys Josh.
Joshua Alcoholic. Thank you, Andy, for that very endearing introduction. I hope that's how I'm remembered when I've died. That guy is fucking nuts. First off, thank you to the committee for asking me to be here and participate. I'm glad I'm here. To the new people, we're very glad you're here as well. You're probably possibly confused, especially if this is like your first introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous. For better or worse, this is not how most meetings are. So like the meeting you go to next, you won't be like frantically rushed to the center of several hundred people by stuffed animals to Don't Stop Believing by Journey, and then kind of inexplicably given a signed book and hear people chant, which what I thought they were saying was rehab book, but I think they were saying read that book. But both possibly do apply. I was talking to a friend about conferences, and I realized that this is probably, I think, well over 100 YPAW that I've attended. gotten the chance to participate in. And I always still like the sobriety countdown. I think because it's such a stark reminder that some of us have only recently just kind of not stood at the door, like the foot of death's door. And especially these days, I've been thinking about the fact that I think what's been going on the street lately, like relapse is a profoundly unforgiving thing. And I know, like, in the meetings I've been going to, every single conference I've been to, people have been lost very recently amongst groups of people. And the same is with me back home in Toronto. People are dying kind of at alarming rates. And I think that's the reality of alcoholism and addiction. And I don't want to start on that as a downer, but I just thought I'd mention that. My sobriety date is October 22nd, 1995, which means I'll be 23 years sober in 2 days. I got sober when I was 19, and it certainly was not my intent to spend over half my life sober in this program. I kind of thought that I would stay here for a little bit. And I can recall, like, when people with a lot of time sober would talk to me and kind of what I felt was like smugly talk about their long-term sobriety, like 3 years or something like that. And they would do it in such a way that I felt they were trying to convey that I should be impressed by it. And I generally wasn't, primarily because I just kind of felt like, how effective is a program that requires membership of such a long-term variety? It would have been sort of like walking through high school and running into a guy that was 40. He's like, "What's up, guys? I'm still in high school." And I didn't quite really understand what the point of long-term sobriety was. Now I kind of get it, which is good because I guess I have it. The other thing I want to say is, if you're new and you're still here, I probably have your attention for about 5 minutes. So I want to dispense with what I think is important information. The first was my sobriety date. The second being that I have a sponsor. His name is Dan F. He attends The Hill in Toronto on Thursday nights. And legend has it that he sits in the back of the meeting so that when newcomers come into the meeting late and they sit down, he can turn to them and shake their hand and say, "Welcome to Alcoholics. My name is Dan." Which is kind of a dick move, but he's been my sponsor for almost 15 years. And Thursday night, I got to present a sponsee with their 10-year medallion, while my sponsor took his 30-year medallion. And I've been eternally grateful for the service that he does in AA, and for the fact that he's never presented himself as more than what he is to me, which is simply just another dude that's been sober for a bit and is happily and freely giving away what he's been given in Alcoholics Anonymous, with the intent that that will keep him sober as well. And the other is, I have a home group. It's called the Corktown Group. We're not like super imaginative in how we name our groups in Toronto. The Corktown Group meets in Corktown. We're on Monday nights. We meet at 7:30. If you ever find yourself in Toronto, please look me up and come to the group. The other is, I want to just thank the committee as a whole for putting this thing on. This is a little blurb for our conference. I'm the 2019 chair for the Ontario Regional Conference in Ontario. And I know that these things don't just suddenly come out of nowhere. They require years of blood, sweat, and tears. And there's a disproportionate amount of effort that goes into making these things happen, for the fact that they only occur over a single weekend. And it's been a great conference, and I wanted to thank you for that. Our conference, which is the Ontario Regional Conference, is happening next year, March 1st, 2nd, and 3rd. And we have about 3,500 attendees and 11 fly-in speakers. My friend Earl H. from Los Angeles is speaking on Saturday night. And we're really hoping that you can come up there. There was a period of time when our conference was attended by a lot of people from the States. And we're hoping to kind of bring that back. Unfortunately, we in Alcoholics Anonymous are also a demographic where we often have criminal records. If you happen to have one of those, I would encourage you to speak to the consulate and see whether or not you are legally allowed to cross the border before you do come across. The other is that I love Alcoholics Anonymous, which was not something I felt when I first came in here. I was 19 years old, and I didn't think AA was cool. Which was funny because prior to getting sober, I had had a stroke as a result of a drug overdose, and I'd paralyzed the left side of my face. So I would do this thing where I would drool on myself, unbeknownst to me, but very visibly to other people, and yet I was concerned about what was or was not cool. And I can remember, like, hanging out with my AA friends and running into somebody that I knew, And I would introduce them, and then a friend would take me aside, and he's like, hey, what's up with all your 40-year-old friends? And like, that's how AA was. But at the same time, I had found myself in a place that, for whatever reason, felt like the first place that I wasn't suffocating. And the message of Alcoholics Anonymous was originally carried to me while I was in corrections, and it was brought by a group of people that were just simply taking time out of their lives to do an H&I panel and talk about things that at that time I thought were quite stupid. But when I hit bottom and at 19, I remembered those people coming in and talking about their own alcoholism and thought possibly that that might be a place that I could go. And I've always been deeply grateful for H&I and the people that do that, because I've kind of felt that if they had not come into the institution that I was in at that time, I don't know if I would have the same sobriety date that I do, because I don't actually know if I would have even known that young people had gotten sober at that point in time. Anyway, this is my story. I was 19 years old and I had my last blackout, at least as far as I know. I came out of that blackout face down in the Mojave Desert, and I used to go to raves, which I feel like I should be ashamed of saying, but I'm not. So I was dressed like Mickey Mouse. I had on those big Mickey Mouse gloves. If you were ever doing raves in the 90s, you know that that was kind of a popular thing, to dress up like Disney characters. If you've also done a lot of psychedelics, you would understand why that would be important. Like, if you had done like a Google aerial view, it would just look like a dead Disney character coming to life. And I have always been a blackout drinker. I think being roughly the size of a large owl, I was constantly drinking past my weight limit. So it was not abnormal for me to come out of blackouts and not know where I was. In fact, I had developed a skill that probably a lot of you are familiar with, which was I had become something of a detective. Like, you know, you would come out of a blackout and it would be like AACSI. Time would sort of slow down. You would surveil your environment, like collect all the evidence, and then just kind of piece together how it is that you would come out of a blackout face down in the Mojave Desert. And the parts that you couldn't quite ascertain, you would simply fill in the blanks. And I came out of that blackout, and oh, here's another thing. At that time, I was actually attending meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the terrifying thing was I had actually attended several meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous in blackouts, which, if you've ever done, is horrible. In fact, if you are currently doing that or ever have done that, that is the death knell of your drinking, because what that means is, if you consider blackout you as a separate entity making its own decisions, that means even like super drunk you is like, hey man, you should stop drinking. And I got sober in Los Angeles, and I remember I somehow managed to make it into the Pacific Group in a blackout, which is a meeting that's around 1,100 people on a weekly Wednesday basis. And in California, we clap at everything because we're so goddamn excited. And I can remember the first round of clapping. I came out of that blackout and looked around and realized, I was like, oh shit, I'm in a meeting of AA. And I always try to share that story in meetings, because if you are currently coming out of a blackout, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. You are perhaps uniquely in the last place in the world that is super happy that you are currently here in a blackout. And so I find myself in the Mojave Desert, and I make my way to a local, I guess, silver mining town. And I go to a payphone and I call my sponsor, or at least the guy that would end up being my sponsor. I kind of explain the situation that I had discovered, and he tells me to come meet him. And I meet him on the boardwalk of Laguna Beach, and we're walking down that boardwalk, and he's explaining a very, what feels like esoteric idea of a God that's personal to myself. And as him and I are talking, this dude materializes out of what feels like thin air, looks at me, and he says, hey man, I'll trade you some hash for your cigarettes. Which, like, on a purely financial transactional basis, seemed like a pretty good deal. And I considered it for a moment, and my sponsor did something that I've always been very grateful for, which is, he looked at me, he looked at the guy, he stepped back, he put his hands up, and he said, it's up to you, man. You gotta make the decision. And I've always kind of felt that if my sponsor had in some way tried to insinuate his own will or tell me what to do, I would have possibly not have the same sobriety date that I have today. I was one of those people that was pathologically incapable of following direction, and also had kind of a clinical problem with authority figures. And when he said it was my decision, it suddenly occurred to me that it was my decision. Like, I was really the only person that could decide if that day was going to be the day that I was going to stop using. And so against my better judgment, I turned that guy down, and he faded back into the shadows from whence he came. And me and my sponsor continued along the boardwalk, having a similar confusing conversation. And here's the thing about my sponsor is, if you're new, you may have heard some good advice about how it is we choose sponsors in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I think one of the more common things is find somebody that has what you want. And I think fundamentally that's good information. The only kind of logical flaw with that is if you're anything like me, and you're new, what you probably want to do is drink, smoke crack, and possibly publicly set yourself on fire, which are three circumstances that are not conducive to happy sobriety. So it's possible that finding somebody that has what you want in that moment may not be the best thing. What I would recommend doing is find somebody that has what they want, because that's probably something that you're lacking in your own life. That being said, the spiritual criteria that I used to choose my original sponsor was he would talk to me, which was important. He had an afro, which I thought was pretty cool, and I thought he would lend me money. And that was why I chose him. And I can remember the first time I asked him if I could borrow money, and he would do one of those, like, you know, those sponsored Jedi mind tricks where he would say something and you didn't realize what he was saying until a minute later. And I said, "Can I borrow some money?" And he looked at me very sincerely and he said, "Listen, man, I want to tell you, never hesitate to ask me that, because the answer will always be no." And it, like, took me a second to figure out what he was saying. And the other thing about my sponsor was he was, like, really into tie-dye, and I had made the mistake of telling him that at one point in time I liked the Grateful Dead and had tried to follow them. And what I didn't have the heart to tell him was once I had stopped smoking weed, I was like, "These guys are just a shitty jam band." And so my sponsor was also the kind of guy that would walk around in public spaces with a boomerang. And we get to this point on the boardwalk, and he's trying to somehow relay this message about a spiritual analogy between boomerangs and surrender. And he's like, "Listen, I want you to take this boomerang and throw it as your first kind of physical act of surrender." And I was like, "I'm not going to do that." And he's like, "Well, why not?" I'm like, "Because I'll, like, hit somebody." And he's like, "Well, that's not how boomerangs work." And so, against my better judgment, I took that boomerang, and I cranked back and threw it as hard as I could and nailed this dude in the back of the head, kind of out along the horizon. And my sponsor ran out onto the beach, arms all akimbo, and he was, like, yelling, "I'm sorry, he's a newcomer." Which, you know, if you're not an Alcoholics Anonymous, that is not a familiar vernacular. So the guy was confused, because he was like, "A newcomer to the beach? That doesn't explain the boomerang." And I remember my sponsor, like, kind of running back to me, like, with the boomerang, with this stupid-ass grin on his face. And that was my first resentment in Alcoholics Anonymous against my sponsor. And this is a dude that I still, like, I'm still in contact with my first sponsor, and he is still nuts, and I still love him. And he was the kind of guy that had the ability to speak in a way that cut through the white noise that was constantly going through my head at that time. I don't know if you've ever stood too close to a power line, but there's just kind of a low hum that permeates everything when you do that. And when I first got sober, that was more or less my complete and total mental state, was just low white noise that buzzed all the time. And whenever my sponsor talked, like, it cut through that for whatever reason. And here's the other thing that I love about my sponsor was, one is that he was crazy, but he was a type of crazy that made me believe him. And I remember that still to this day, because I think I trusted him as a result of not having been entirely restored to sanity at a socially acceptable level. Because some of the people who were, I guess, as I would like to think, as sane as I am today, I just thought were narcs, basically. And I think that's something to remember for myself, is that I should never become so perfect that I cease to become effective in carrying the message to the alcoholic that still suffers. Because I trusted him because I felt that he was an alcoholic like I was. And we attend my first meeting in my first bit of sobriety, and I remember the speaker. It was a guy named Dick, and that was his real name, Dick. He like came from an era where I guess it was okay to name your kids Dick, not Richard, but just straight up Dick. And he shared this story, and I think this is kind of like an alcoholic cliche or a dodge where you go into your first meeting and the speaker is speaking and you almost feel paranoid in the sense that maybe people in your life had called ahead and notified the speaker that you were coming and they're like, share this stuff because they'll relate to that. And I felt that way. Like, this guy was telling my story. Like, I felt everything that he said I related to. And I never want to forget that night because I had, over a period of time, gotten to know good old Dick quite well. And if there was ever an old man that had the exact opposite of my story, it was him. Like, there is nothing in his story that's like mine. But for whatever reason, I was in a position where I was finally willing to hear the message of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I related to him. And I remember he would talk about, like, he was an old naval admiral, and he would drink in the blackouts and lose, like, where he had parked his battleship. And I was like, oh, shit, like, I drink to blackouts and lose stuff. And whenever I'm in meetings and I feel like for whatever reason that I'm not hearing what it is that I need to hear, I need to remember that first day in that meeting and my ability to relate on a level that I was incapable of relating to at that time and somehow try to get back to that place, because it was that ability that basically saved my life. The other thing I remember is in California, you would stand up if you're a newcomer. And I stood up and introduced myself as a newcomer. And immediately after sitting down, the guy in front of me turned to me and handed me a card. And it was just a plain white card with the name Ron W., his phone number, and 24 hours a day, which I didn't quite understand. And he looked at me and he said, listen, the next time you want a drink, call me first. And then kind of smugly turned around and sat back down. And I was like, this guy doesn't want to stay sober. He wants to go drinking with me. I didn't really understand what the point of what he was doing at that time. And the other thing I remember is like the AA slogans and coming into that meeting and this big biker dude trying to shake my hand and saying, you're no longer alone, which I took as a threat because that felt like a threat. I don't know about you, but prior to getting sober, I did an unhealthy amount of methamphetamines. And if you've ever done methamphetamines, you know you develop a kind of a unique form of paranoia to the point that you lose the ability to kind of tell the difference between rational paranoia and irrational paranoia. And I came into AA with that. And I can remember my sponsor like getting pissed off at me and saying, stop asking me if everybody's a narc. Because I just was so paranoid when I got sober. And him and I start working the steps, and we start working step one. And the interesting thing is my sponsor diagnosed my alcoholism by talking about his own drinking. And I've always found that very interesting in the sense that in Alcoholics Anonymous, we often will diagnose another alcoholic's alcoholism simply by talking about our own experience with alcohol. And which is kind of crazy when you think about it, because alcoholism, if you think about it as a legitimate medical condition, that would be like if you went to the doctor's office with some sort of undiagnosed condition and you went into that back room and you sat down on that leather couch covered by that awkward tissue paper, and the doctor kind of comes in and looks at you and takes his stethoscope and like puts it to his own chest and he's like, just what I thought. Have you ever had like a sniffle or a sore throat? Like, does that sound familiar to you? Like, and diagnosing your condition by simply talking about previous medical conditions that he had had. And, but that's how my sponsor talked about my alcoholism, was by talking about his own alcoholism. And then he gave me the space to figure out whether or not it was that I belonged here. And the other thing that he did was he gave me the space to talk about my own drinking. And we did that. And he asked me to talk about my first drink, and I did. And my first drink goes a little bit farther back than simply my first drink. I was born in the Philippines, like so many Filipinos are. And and both of my parents, like my biological parents, were intravenous drug users. And as my social work papers say, highly irresponsible. And I've always wondered, like, how irresponsible do you have to be where that's literally the only legal description of who you were as a parent, highly irresponsible? My guess is pretty goddamn irresponsible. And I can remember being told that I probably had a genetic predilection toward alcoholism and drug addiction. Apparently in the Filipino culture, it's considered uncool to have a child out of wedlock and be an intravenous drug user, because my parents quickly put me up for adoption, and I was adopted by, for lack of better words, two white people, or who I shall refer to as my parents. And they adopted myself and five other Asian kids. And I think they did that out of just the goodness of their heart and maybe like a mild Asian fetish. And we grew up in this, what I felt like, super chaotic household. And I can remember we would go to these like cultural preservation heritage days where all the parents would bring their adopted kids to and they would preserve their heritage. And the first thing that I would notice when we'd show up to these events was that all of the kids were wearing just normal Oshkosh B'gosh or whatever the hell kids wear, and all of us were dressed in kimonos, which is not even culturally appropriate for a Filipino. And I can remember just kind of like leaning up against the wall, I don't know, like smoking a fake cigarette or something, and thinking, this is bullshit. And from like the very beginning, it felt like there was a very dominant message that was being delivered of all avenues of my life, and that message simply was, you're different. And it felt like everything that happened was some sort of reinforcement of that message. I can remember, like, I was a very, well, I like to think precocious child. That was not the word that child psychologists use with me. But I would, when I entered rooms, it was really important that I lick my finger and touch all the adults on their bare skin. And also equally important that they don't notice that I do that. I would often take immediate mental inventory of all the metal objects. If time allowed, I would also lick my finger and touch all of those things. And I felt like I was conducting very important scientific experiments with my own urine. And these were the things that were happening in my life predating even my first drink. One of my favorite descriptions of alcoholism in the Big Book is in the very back of the appendices, which is the section that is dedicated to medical professionals basically writing their glowing opinions on Alcoholics Anonymous. And this particular line is written by a non-alcoholic. It was this doctor for the American Institute of Medicine, and he called alcoholism an excessive concentration upon self. And I've always thought, that is a really good description of the type of alcoholism that occurs when you're not drinking. And that was me at the age of 10 years old, and I took my first drink, and it was at that party that you get invited to when you're finally cool, and it was vodka and Kool-Aid, and we start drinking, and we shoot fireworks at cars, which I don't know about Buffalo, but that's illegal where I come from. And the cops start chasing us, and they corner us in a field, and they start asking our names, and all of my friends are quickly giving up their names and their parents' phone numbers, and the cop looks at me, and I feel the effects of alcohol for the first time in my life. And without even really any sort of conscious thought, I say, sir, my name is Richard Head. And the cop looks at me, and he's like, son, are you trying to tell me your name is Dickhead? And I said, well, sir, I've always preferred Richard. And the cop nudges his cop buddy, they look at each other, they look at us, and they laugh, and they just let us all go free. And we walk away from that convinced that we had just escaped juvenile incarceration directly as a result of what I had just done. And my friends were patting me on the back and saying that that was the most awesome thing they'd ever seen. And I knew that was true. Like, I knew that that was the most awesome thing they'd ever seen. And I suspect very likely still is the most awesome thing they'd ever seen. Like, I feel like if I went on Facebook tonight and searched them out, I would quickly find a status update that was like, hey, remember the most awesome thing we ever saw? And it would be a recounting of that event. And like, I don't know, like 40 likes or something like that. And that was my first experience drinking. And what I knew, even though I wouldn't have articulated that at the age of 10, is that I had acted extemporaneously in a manner that I was incapable of doing when I was sober. Whereas normally I would have been paralyzed with fear, I had done something almost without thought, and the outcome had been that. When I first got sober, I was mildly alarmed that it seemed that what you were suggesting was that the solution to my alcoholism was God, like God with a capital G. And it wasn't that I had any real misgivings with God, I just thought that that might be a fairly ineffective solution for someone like me, which is a super arrogant thing to think, but that's nonetheless what I thought. I think, like, I would have felt more comfortable if I was in the meeting and I looked over in the corner and there would have been like some old timer there with like one of those weird transparent bookie hats on. And at the end of the meeting, he would have pointed me out and he's like, hey kid, come over here. And I would have gone over and he would have like pulled a Big Book down off the shelf and it would have swung around. And then we would have gone into this room and in the middle of the room was like a gold-plated microwave with a door open running. And he's like, yeah, we just jerry-rigged this microwave so it still runs while the door's open. We stay sober through mild radiation exposure. Like, that would have felt more logical to me than the possibility of God. And but if you really think about it, like if you think about the idea of a spiritual solution as a way of treating alcoholism, like it makes sense. One of the reasons I knew that I could probably do business with the spirituality that you guys were talking about in AA was because very early on in the big book, one of the first descriptions of the spirituality that we talk about, or the psychic change as it's called, is a profound alteration in the way that we react to life. Like a profound alteration in the way that we react to life. And when I heard that, I thought that was incredibly good verbiage to describe what alcohol did for me when it was working. A profound and instantaneous alteration in the way that I reacted to life. Like, that's exactly what happened to me when I was 10 years old. And I think you'd actually have to be kind of stupid not to pursue that to the best of your ability, which is exactly what I did. Like, my first day drinking, it was like as we were walking away with my friends patting me on the back, I saw God stroll over the horizon with long, luxurious hair blowing in the wind, and he would walk right past us and high-five me right in front of my friends. And like that was my spiritual awakening. That was my change of person. Like in that moment, I had transformed from somebody that I used to be into somebody that I now was. And I knew that was a result of drinking. And I don't know if that story necessarily makes me alcoholic, because certainly there was other friends of mine that were there that were probably not alcoholics. But I do know that shortly thereafter, something happened to me that was alcoholic, which was I quickly found that whereas a lot of my friends were drinking to get drunk because we were 10, I seemed to be drinking because I had to get drunk. And I didn't really understand that compulsion, but I did know that as soon as I started drinking, I had to follow it through to a certain extent that it seemed like very quickly not everybody was willing or capable to go to. And I didn't even necessarily feel like I wanted to go there. I just felt like I had to go there. I listen to a lot of podcasts because I'm a douche, I guess. I don't know. But... I often listen to podcasts about traumatic events that happen to collective groups of people because that for some reason reassures me. And there's this one episode that I was listening to where they're interviewing people that had been abducted for long periods of time, like basically taken hostage. And I was struck by this one particular interview where the guy was talking to him and they were talking about the Stockholm Syndrome, which if you don't know what that is, it's this phenomenon that happens where abductees will often develop positive and affectionate, trusting feelings toward their captors based on this almost reflexive need to find the most minute positive traits in that person as a way of dealing with the trauma of their environment and to cope with it. And in its most extreme cases, they will often find themselves actually committing crimes with their abductors. And at one point, the guy was talking, and he kind of broke down for a moment and said the thing that terrified him the most was that ever so often, like years after this experience, he would find himself almost having pleasant nostalgic memories of that time. And I thought, that's really similar to like what my relationship to alcohol was. Like basically a form of Stockholm Syndrome. There's a part in the book that often alludes to the fact that as alcoholics, we lack the ability to recall with any sort of accuracy the nightmare that our drinking has been even just mere weeks away. And I sometimes think that is important fact to remember. Like that is kind of why we talk about our drunkologues. I mean, I think there's this idea that as alcoholics, we all know how to drink. But the reality is one of the forms of untreated alcoholism is an inability to actually accurately recall how it is that we as an individual drink. Like, I didn't actually even know the extent of my drinking until after I had been sober for a while. A lot of my drinking was clouded in simply not remembering, denial, diminishing, exaggeration. These were all parts of what my drinking were like. And I don't remember why I was talking about that, but it seemed important at the time. So me and my sponsor are working step one, and he also tells me to ask him about a time that I felt a form of powerlessness. And what he meant by that was he had asked me if I had begun to find that I often had like these grand plans about how it was that I was going to in some way change the trajectory of my life. And that often I would find myself successfully executing those plans. And what would happen is my life would get worse and everybody else's would get worse as well. And he said, like, if you find yourself in that position where all of your best plans are actually making your life worse, that's a form of powerlessness. And I talked to him about this one time where I was, at this point in time, I think I was 18 years old. I was sitting in a car next to my friend. My friend was holding a gun to my head and threatening to kill me, which was making me question our friendship. I had stolen some product from him that he was not taking kindly to, and I was pretty sure he was going to kill me. And the evidence that I was using was we were parked near a body of water. I was pretty sure he had killed people before, and he had a loaded gun pointed at my head and was saying, "I'm going to kill you." And the thoughts that were going through my head were, please just pull the trigger. I don't know why it is that I do the things that I do, but I can't stop doing them. I can't remember the last time that I've had an authentic relationship with another person. Everybody in my family has burned every single bridge with me. Nobody wants to see me. In the mornings when I come to, because the sun is coming through the corrugated steel that covers the dumpster that I spend most nights in, and then spend the rest of the day doing whatever it is that I need to do to get what I need, and then I'm unfortunate enough to catch a glimpse of myself in a storefront window and then cringe with disgust with the flat fact that I lack the courage to blow my own head off, please just pull the trigger. And at the exact same time that I was thinking that, the other thought that was going through my head was, I wonder if I can pop the door handle and roll out of the car before he pulls the trigger. And for me, that was like the great internal alcoholic dilemma. Bill W. sums up the condition of alcoholism very succinctly in the Big Book when he simply says that lack of power was our dilemma. And what that meant for me in that moment was I literally lacked any sort of internal resource that had the ability to propel my life in a direction that ever resulted in any form of sustained period of contented satisfaction. And the guy was like, this is pathetic. Get out of the car and kill yourself. Otherwise, you'd probably have a different speaker. And I remember stumbling out of that car and that being one of the darkest days of my drinking. And yet at that time, not being able to come to Alcoholics Anonymous because I was still under the illusion that the alcohol and the drugs were in some way serving me. And I told my sponsor that. And it was all of these qualifications that led him to the suggestion that possibly I too was an alcoholic. And we went to step two. And I can remember reading through that step two and becoming increasingly alarmed by the language that was being used, particularly the word faith. And I can remember saying to my sponsor, like, you know, thank you for taking the time to do this with me. I'm deeply appreciative. But like, if faith is something that's required for me to stay sober, I don't know if I can do this. Like, that's not something that I really have. And I don't think I really ever have had. And my sponsor did something interesting, which is something that I do myself, is in the time that he allowed me to tell my own stories, he did so for the sole purpose of using those stories against me. And in step two, when I began to raise what I felt was a rational argument as to why it is that I could not work the steps, he used this particular story against me. I did a 2-month period of juvenile corrections, and during that period of time, if you were ever in the doctor's office and you saw medication, you stole it because obvious reasons. And I was in the doctor's office at this one point, and I saw this box of medication. On the box, it had a picture of two old people walking down the beach hand in hand, and the words "for the ease of pain and discomfort." And I stole it knowing that it was muscle relaxants, which is one of my favorite things. And I brought it back to the corrections and shared it with my friends, because ultimately I'm just a spiritual being having a human experience. And me and my friends took quite a bit of that. And about an hour later, it occurred to me that two old people walking down the beach hand in hand and the words "for the ease of pain and discomfort," we had all just overdosed on prescription strength laxatives. And for the next couple hours, we would turn our will and our lives over to a power greater than we understood. And my sponsor used this particular story to help understand step two, because he told me it was not the quantity of faith in my life that I'd lacked, it was the quality of faith. And what he meant by that was I'd simply never really had faith in anything worth having faith in. And furthermore, what he meant by that was in that moment, the only evidence I required to take an action was a picture of two old people walking down the beach hand in hand and the words "for the ease of pain and discomfort." And instantly, I turned my will and my life over to it, convinced that it would take me where I wanted to go. Definitively, that's faith. And when he said that, it was like I understood it. And I got it. And I've had the opportunity of being in Alcoholics Anonymous and going all over the world, partially for AA. And what I've observed is that within our membership that numbers in the millions, our religious and spiritual affiliations are across the entire spectrum of such a thing, ranging all the way from militant atheists to Bible-thumping Christians, like that full spectrum of people with different beliefs. And what I like about our Big Book is the only suggestion we place on your higher power is this: that it not be you, that it be something that you understand, and that it be something that has the power to restore you to sanity. And like, that's it. And if you're here tonight and you feel like you're constantly finding yourself doing the same things over and over, and you're in this position when you're asking yourself, why does this always happen to me? The one thing that I can say is you might want to look at what your higher power is, because fundamentally, regardless of what it is that I tell you my higher power is, it's the thing that I allow to call all the shots. That's my higher power. Regardless of what I say it is, it's the thing that I allow to call the shots. That's what my higher power is. Like, that's what alcohol was for me, was the thing that called all the shots. And we moved on to step three, and I can remember coming to my sponsor at a period of time with a problem, that problem being that I had had my first breakup in sobriety. All romantic breakups in sobriety are horrible, unless I'm sponsoring you, in which case I just tell you to get over it. But I can remember I had broken up with this girl. I was basically a teenager. And I was doing this thing where I was being the greeter at a meeting that she also went to. And my spiritual intent was that I would greet people so that when she came through the door, I would be the first person that she would see. And we would clasp hands in a greeting-like fashion. And I would look her deep in the eyes and I would say something that would make her feel so guilty that she would get back together with me. And unsurprisingly, I was going nuts. And I brought that situation to my sponsor, and I asked him what I should do, and he was like, well, I think you should let go and let God. And I was like, what the fuck does that mean? Like, can you just use, like, English or something? And I said, like, in practicality, what does it mean to let go and let God when you feel like your life is falling apart around you? And he's like, well, I mean, off the top of my head, you could stop stalking your ex-girlfriend. And what occurred was I came to another person and I presented them with a problem and they gave me a solution and I made the decision to take that direction. And ultimately that has been my third step to this day, is that I bring these problems and I bring my life to something outside of myself and I become willing to be teachable and take direction. And in the original moment, what it simply meant was that I became willing to do my inventory and I became willing to do my four step. And I started doing my four step, and it was that list of all the secrets that have been keeping me sick. And I bring that inventory to my sponsor, and I read that inventory with my fifth step. And at the end of it, he did something which I found incredible, which was, he said, now tell me all the things that you didn't write down. And I thought he was like a wizard. I've since then found that that's a fairly common question in fifth step inventories, and there had definitely been a lot of stuff that I had not written down. And here is the beautiful thing about AA. Trauma is not like an uncommon thing in this fellowship. Most of us have gone through certain things. And I had gone through quite a lot. Like, I may get into it a little bit more, but I'm a little bit pressed for time. But I was incarcerated for 2 years in a place that was constantly being shut down by child protection agencies because of the rampant accusations of physical and sexual abuse being performed against minors. And I came into that fifth step with a lot of stuff that I just felt like, what is the point of telling, like, another adult dude this stuff in order to not drink? Like, that doesn't even make sense. And it was stuff that I just felt, like, ashamed of. Like, it didn't seem like I should tell someone this stuff. But when he asked me, like, to tell him all the things that I hadn't written down, it occurred to me that if I really wanted what he had, which was happy and contented sobriety, then I had to come clean for the first time in my life. Like, completely clean. And against my better judgment, I did. Like, I told him everything. And at the end of it, he was, like, uncharacteristically quiet. And he looked at me, and he did this super awkward thing where he just put his hand over my hand, and he said, for what it's worth, I'm sorry these things happened to you. Like, in a perfect world, these things really shouldn't happen to any kid. But fortunately for you, it's no longer an excuse to live the way that you were living. And in the big book, when it talks about our initial experience with an inventory, it talks about this idea of glimpsing liberty through these, I think, the arches of freedom, like this idea that we're no longer alone in the world. And I kind of had that sense. Like, in hindsight, I realized that the birth of that idea that I was no longer tethered to my past, like, it was there that occurred. And what happened for me is it suddenly occurred to me that the only person that needed a change in my life in order for me to stay sober was me. And having now found some sort of internal resource that I was beginning to call my higher power, I realized that that was actually possible. And so we moved on to my sixth and seventh, and this is an ongoing thing. If you've ever read the big book, which I really encourage, you know there's not a lot written about six and seven. In fact, there is literally as much written about six and seven as there is about like if you're suffering from impotence to go see a doctor, or that a good alternative to alcohol cravings is eating candy. Like there's almost the same amount of deliberated wordplay invested in those things as there is to 6 and 7, like two very prominent steps. And I believe that the reason that is because at that point in time, Dr. Bob and Bill W. didn't even realize what it would look like to actually do these steps in full and to like commit yourself to doing these things. There's an incredible article written in the Grapevine by Bill W. called Emotional Sobriety. In that, it's written with, I think he had around 16 years of sobriety at that point in time. And he talks about this idea of having set down the drink, we often find that we have not necessarily surrendered some of our grosser handicaps that would later come back in later years and emotionally cripple us. And I think that's what 6 and 7 is this constant willingness to look at who we are. And I move on to my 8th step, and I begin making that inventory of the people that I had harmed, and I bring that inventory to my sponsor, and I can remember sitting with him in his car and reading through that entire 8th step, and at the end of it feeling super depressed, and him turning to me and saying, "I bet this feels like an impossible task." And I remember just feeling like really depressed because it felt like a barrier, and I was like, I don't think I can do this. Like, I don't even know how there's any way I could possibly make amends to all these people. I don't even know where these people are. I don't have that kind of money. I don't want to see some of these people. A lot of these people don't want to see me. I have no idea how I can do this. And my sponsor said, "I'm going to tell you what was said to me, and that was this. If you are willing to make these amends, whatever is required to make those amends will be given to you. And I guarantee you that because that was my own experience." And at this point in my sobriety, I've had the opportunity to tell probably hundreds of guys that exact same statement, that if you are willing to make these amends, whatever is required to make them will be given to you. And I misinterpreted what he said, because one of the easy ways I interpreted that was, when I am willing to pay back that money, maybe I'll open my mailbox and there'll be like, I don't know, an envelope of money. But what happened was I became employable and I got a job and I started earning money. And I started saving that money, and I started becoming willing to use that money to pay back people, not my money, but their money. And I became a kind of person that people who previously did not want to see me suddenly became willing to hear me out. And I can remember my doing my 9-step with my parents, and at first, I started doing it with them, and they were like, "Listen, you don't have to do this. Like, we appreciate that you're doing this, but we don't want you to do it. Like, we know that you'll just go back to your old ways. We just don't want you to get our hopes up," which is a really shitty thing to say to somebody. And here's the thing, they weren't trying to hurt me. Like, they meant no harm in saying that. They had just reached a point where that was simply the reality that they faced, which was that my word was nothing and that eventually I would hurt them again. Like, the last interaction prior to my 9-step that I'd have with my mother was standing at the front door of the house that I'd grown up in, and the door is open a crack, and my mother had installed one of those security chains, one of those things that had not been there prior to, like, that I could remember. And she was holding the door open, and I could see her eyes, and they were bloodshot because she'd been crying. And she said, "Listen, you're our son, and we love you, and we'll never stop loving you. But wherever it is you're going, we can't go there with you. And if we see you back here again, we'll call the cops." And like, that was where my relationship had gone with them. And I persisted at the behest of my sponsor, and eventually that amends was made. And I have a relationship with my parents today. And the interesting thing was, is when I got sober, I had no interest in having any kind of rekindled relationship with anybody. And I can remember talking to my sponsor and saying, my parents want nothing to do with me. This isn't going to work. And he said, "Well, I'll give you two alternatives that will happen. One is you will reconcile this relationship. The other is you'll do this and you'll find peace in whatever that relationship becomes. Essentially, it's a win-win situation for you." And he was right. Like, that's exactly what happened. And like, my parents hang out with my sponsor, which is kind of weird, to be honest. Like, every so often, I'll go on Facebook, and I'll see my sponsor and my parents talking to each other, and I'm like, what the fuck? The other is this amends, which I should talk about. When I was 15 years old, I tried to kill myself, and I had reached the point of my drinking and using that I thought the only way out of my lifestyle was suicide, and I was also facing a fairly lengthy term in juvenile hall, and I was kind of not wanting to do that, so I tried to kill myself. And when I first told my sponsor the information about the suicide attempt, he said if I'm ever given the chance to speak, God forbid, to relay back these events verbatim, because he felt it was a wonderful example of a God working in my life at a time that I didn't believe in one. And what had happened is I was going to kill myself through carbon monoxide poisoning, and I had stolen a car, which was something of a habit, and I had stolen a hose because, well, I'd already stolen a car. And I parked at this, what I thought was an abandoned business complex, and I put the hose into the exhaust pipe, looped it back into the van, turned it on, sat back, and waited to die. And I can remember before losing consciousness, when I got sober, there were certain parts of the Big Book that would jump out at me. And one of them was the lines, pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. And when I read that line, my suicide attempt kind of flashed back at me. And what I recalled was at one point in time, I regained consciousness, figured out that I wasn't dead, took the hose off the floor of the van, stuck it into my mouth, and started sucking desperately off it in the hopes that it would kill me. And I think when you're 15 years old and you're sitting in a stolen van with a hose literally in your mouth, just desperately hoping to die, like that is what they're talking about with pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. And what happened was later retold to me because I was unconscious, but by Sunday morning, I wasn't dead yet, and this group of people came into work, and this one guy went in through the back, and he said as he was opening the door, he saw the van and had a strange feeling come over him, so he went over and investigated. I assume that strange feeling was, why is this window, or why is this van still on with these foggy windows? And he came over and figured out what I was doing, pulled me out of the van, brought me into that office, and that group of people started talking to me. I remember that the guy who found me said that he believes that ever so often God gives us the opportunity to right what was once wrong, and that years before his brother had killed himself. And I also remember being really pissed off at this guy because he'd screwed up my suicide attempt. And I remember my father walking in with the first responders, and he was crying, and I'd never seen my father cry, and just absolutely despising myself. And I was rushed to the hospital and treated for carbon monoxide poisoning. I was almost comatose, and I can remember the doctors telling me that I should feel really lucky that I was alive, because a normal person would have a carbon monoxide level of a 2 or 3, and mine was like a 35, which was literally minutes away from dying. And I don't know why I'm still alive. I believe I'm somewhat on borrowed time. And here's why I love this story in AA, is this is not an uncommon story. Like most of us can think back at moments where there's no really appreciable reason why it is that we're still alive and fortunate enough to be sitting here tonight sober. Like that is not an uncommon story that you literally escape death by seconds, if not inches. And it's interesting, like I speak a lot, and one of the sort of the things of a good story is that the story in and of itself is unique. In fact, that is the point of any story, is to in some way narrate some sort of unique point. Whereas in Alcoholics Anonymous, like the most powerful stories are the ones that are used where people relate to each other. Like if anything, what I'm trying to do is constantly conform my stories in such a way that another person can relate. Like I'm no longer trying to create this unique narrative, because it was literally that unique narrative that was killing me when I got sober. And I think that's incredible. Like our own abilities to use our stories to help other people relate. And my sponsor told me to make amends to these people that had saved my life. I don't know why. I suspect because they saved my life. But it wasn't like I'd harmed them. He said, I want you to find these people and just thank them. It was a super easy amends to make because I hadn't really harmed them. I would assume they'd probably be pretty happy to see me, just come in and say, hey, thanks for saving my life. I was unwilling to make that amends for six continuous years. In my sixth year, I was having something of an existential crisis. That existential crisis being that I didn't really believe in anything existential. And I thought there might be an associative reason with that and my unwillingness to make this amends. So I decided to make that amends, and I went back to that business complex to find these people. After searching several offices, I couldn't find them. And I went back to my car, and I said a very simple prayer, and that prayer was this. God, if it be your will, I think it's really important I make this amends today. And if it is your will, please give me a sign and make it really fucking obvious because I'm stupid. Immediately after saying that prayer, the thought occurred to me, try one more place. And so I walked into one more office, and sitting behind the counter was this woman that had been there that day. and not entirely willing to give it up. I said to her, ma'am, the reason I am here today is because years ago my brother tried to kill himself here. And she looked at me and she said, no, I think it was you. And she came around the counter and she hugged me and started crying, and then I started crying, and then we went back and I met the dude that had saved my life years before. And I did exactly what my sponsor asked me to do, which was I began to tell them what my life was like in that time, and I thanked them for saving my life. And the interesting thing was, in the time that I was telling them about what my life was like, it suddenly occurred to me that I was actually really grateful that I was alive, and I really was quite thankful that they had saved my life. And I'm embarrassed to say that at 6 years of sobriety, it had not yet occurred to me that I was grateful that I was alive. It would take that amends for that to happen. And what I like, and this has been the hallmark of my spiritual growth, is that I took a physical action and a spiritual outcome occurred. And a lot of us have these crazy stories where we're doing amends or we're trying to do the right thing, and it seems like the universe bends over backwards to in some way accommodate us to do this thing. And it's like as if life were like this blank canvas where these millions of lights are constantly flitting across it, and ever so often two or more of those lights collide in such a way and so bright to be undeniable in their existence. And what happened is I took that physical action, and some sort of connection to a thing that I call my higher power today was formed and to this day has never been severed. I don't know why that happened. I don't even really believe in a conventional God, but I do know that there's something out there that is both part of me and larger than me. And I'm running out of time, so I'm going to just end with a couple stories. For the sake of argument, I did work the rest of the steps, and they were really cool. I just want to talk a little bit about what it's like today. I don't like school. When I was younger, I saw this movie called War Games. In War Games, Matthew Broderick plays this protagonist, and it suddenly occurs to him that if he just hacked into the schools and he could just put all of his own grades in, and that's how he graduated from high school. And I remember seeing that and feeling like, you know, that's a way better academic track than the one I'm currently on. And so that was the kind of thing that I studied. During the period of time, the 2 years when I was in juvenile hall, I was also legally not allowed to touch computers, which I ignored. And I broke into their computer system, and I essentially hacked into the school mainframe because we were required to go to high school, or at least take high school curriculum. And I just simply entered all my high school grades and graduated high school with a 3.56 GPA, which I'm still really proud of. I have physically only gone to high school for half of my freshman year. That's the extent of my education. When I told my sponsor that, he was like, you gotta make amends in some way. And I called one of the people that was associated with this place and I told him what I had done, and I was noticeably regretful, and he was like, listen man, if you were smart enough to do that, you probably could have graduated from high school. Good luck in college. And I went back to college and I studied architecture and I busted my ass. And I've been working in that field for several years. I'm an associate partner in a small firm where we do this artsy-fartsy architecture. And like my biggest problem today is ever so often I get in my way and I'm like, I'm just like a service for rich people. But like when I get out of my way, I just enjoy my life and the things that I do. And you know, most of us really need to work on our work ethic when we first get sober. Like my last job before I got sober, I was working in, I think it was like a Subway sandwich, and no offense to anyone who currently works in food service, but let's be honest, you can do that job high. And I can remember coming into work really high, and it was one of those jobs where I was like, this is gonna be the job where I take it serious, I'm just gonna put my head down and put the time in, and things are gonna get better. And I just couldn't even show up to work sober. And I would see this, like, what I felt was a super complicated sandwich making system that was difficult to navigate, and so I would just do what I felt like a real sandwich artist would do, which is I would arbitrarily make sandwiches. And this guy came into the shop this one day. At that point in time, I had been awake for about 7 days. If you've ever done meth and been awake for 7 days, you know you're not high. You're just consecutively existing in an alternate reality. And things can trigger your kind of existence in that. And this guy came in and he said something that blew my mind, which was, no onions. And as soon as he said that, it was like him and I were like transported to the opposite ends of this tunnel. And as I looked down through this tunnel at him, it was like this spinning vortex of color and a single word being whispered over and over in like a hypnotic house beat, that word being onions, 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 onions. And then suddenly like I snapped out of it and I'm looking at the guy and he's looking at me with that kind of typical look of confusion and contempt and disgust, and I look down and there's just like a sandwich with a pile of onions. And I look up and he looks at me and he's like, what is this, fucking joke? And I'm like, is this a joke? And I can remember like that incident cutting so deep because like here's the thing about some of the incidences that we have when we're drinking. Sometimes it's the most innocuous events that cut the deepest because I don't know if you're like me, but when really super traumatic events would happen, I would just brush them off because I always felt like when these things would happen to me, it was like, this makes sense because you're the type of person that this stuff happens to. But when something like where you can't make a no onion sandwich, like that would cut super deep. And that was like my work ethic that I came into school to AA with. And I also, I'll tell a couple stories to end my talk because I think my time is up. This is my story about the spirituality that I found in Alcoholics Anonymous. I always relate the story about my father. I came from a large family, like I said, and this one thing that my dad would do with me and just me is we would try to hike up this mountain together. And if you do come from a large family, you know kind of the importance of just, I guess, you and dad time or whatever. But we would hike up this mountain, and we would never summit the peak because I would always get altitude sickness. And we'd turn around without question, and sometimes I'd be so sick that my father would carry me down the rest of the mountain without any complaint. And in sobriety for one of his birthdays, I thought it'd be really cool if I flew us out to this mountain and like we summited it as adult men. And he was really into that, and we go to this mountain, and we're hiking up it, and we get to that same three-quarter mark where we would normally get that I would get sick, and this huge electrical storm blows over the top, and the rangers come down, and they're like, everybody's got to turn around. It's too dangerous to summit the peak today. So again, without question, we turn around, and me and my father are going down, and like this monsoon is coming down on us, and my father stops, and he's like, this has been a great day, because that's how my dad talks. And and I'm like, Dad, I got to tell you, like, I was really hoping that we would summit the peak today. You know, we'd always tried to do this when I was a kid, and I was never able to do it. And I think you were just trying to make me stronger. And I always felt like I let you down. And he was like, I never cared if we summited the peak. I just wanted to spend time with you, which was not really something that I had ever really considered. And I tell that story because my own journey with spirituality was that I was not one of those people that was even seeking God. I was just simply seeking to be a different person. And in the process of working the steps, all of the things that had blocked me from really this idea of spirituality were removed, and that thing availed itself to me. And my experience is, I guess, similar to the fish in the ocean questioning the existence of water and finding that it's been surrounded by it its entire life. Like, that is the spirituality that I found in Alcoholics Anonymous. And here's the last story I'll end with. When I was in school at one point in time, we were doing this late night project, and we hadn't slept or eaten for about 36 hours, and we started talking about drinking stories. Have you ever had the experience with a group of normies where they start doing drinking stories, and you're like, oh, I got drinking stories, and you get in there with your best drinking story, and shit gets dark like super fast? So they start doing drinking stories, and I get in there with my best drinking story, and this is that story. When I was 16 years old, I was doing a stint of 2 years in juvenile hall, and it suddenly occurred to me while under the influence of LSD that I didn't deserve to be there. And so I escaped, and I stole one of their vans, which was owned by the state, so that was felony count number one. And I crossed a couple state lines, me and my friend, in that van, which was felony count number two. And we're on the lam, and if you've ever done LSD, you know that the plans you make at one point in time, about 8 hours later, they stop making sense. And that's what happened to us. And at one point in time, we had been gone for several days. We were just finishing up a bag of granola that I had stolen, and we were pretty hungry. And I called the place up, and I'm like, hey, we painted the van. We're in Mexico. Fuck you. And they're like, hey, listen, guys, if you turn yourself in tonight, we'll buy you Chinese food. So we're like, okay. And we turn ourselves in, and they come out and apprehend us and bring us back and just beat the living shit out of us. And we do 3 months of solitary confinement. And I've told this story in Alcoholics Anonymous probably hundreds of times. And after I told that to these friends, they were looking at me in a way that I've never seen anyone in AA look at me. And they asked me a question which I hadn't considered, and that question was, why were you in juvenile hall at the age of 16? And I thought, that's not the fucking point of the story. That's like the venue of the story, or like some context of the story, but that's not the point of the story. And the reason I love the Fellowship of AA is because, for the most part, the only question I've ever been asked in this program is, did they buy you the Chinese food? And I think the reason you asked me that question is because fundamentally you understand the point of the story. And as funny as that is, it's actually quite remarkable in the sense that if you're new, you have entered into a community and fellowship of people that understand the points of our stories. Like, we understand where you're coming from. And a lot of other people don't, and frankly, they shouldn't. Our stories hurt a lot of people and often make no sense in any sort of fashion. But we are the type of people that understand your stories. And if you have not yet had the experience of sitting across from another alcoholic who is in AA because, one, they're not entirely sure what alcoholism is, or if they belong in alcohol in AA, or really if there exists a solution for them, and you have told your stories to them, and you have seen them suddenly realize that they're no longer alone in this world, where prior to that, they had convinced themselves that there was no one like them. I encourage you to go out and do that, because it is what we offer in this program, is that experience to turn all of the things, like all of that suffering and desperation that would eventually drive us into Alcoholics Anonymous, in a way that in some way bring another person to a point of redemption. And if that doesn't just fucking thrill the hell out of you, like, I think you're missing the point of Alcoholics Anonymous, because that is what we have here. And I just want to thank you again for allowing me to take part in that, and thanks. Yeah.